You're listening to the We Are Libertarians Podcast Network. Find all of our shows at wearelibertarians.com.
Episode 21, The Paradox.
Welcome to The Paradox with your attending, Dr. Eric Larson. He is a practicing anesthesiologist and clinical assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Human Medicine. Listen in as he takes you behind the scenes of what practicing medicine in today's ever-changing world is like with another doctor. The Paradox is a fun and accidentally informative show for physicians, patients, or anyone who has ever found themselves in a waiting room.
Welcome, I'm your host, Dr. Eric Larson. This is episode 21 of The Paradox. Today we're going to be talking to Dr. Anish Koka about public reporting. It's actually, a rarely reported phenomenon in medicine. But specifically, public reporting involves the reporting of statistics on hospitals, either as a state function or sometimes a federal function. And so hospitals and providers will have to provide outcome data for, say, their surgeries or certain types of conditions like diabetes or heart disease or strokes. And what this course causes is some interesting phenomena in medicine where it discourages you from taking care of difficult patients and cases. So as you can imagine, if you don't want your numbers to look bad, you'll avoid taking care of the people who are more sick. And oftentimes it's very difficult to tell who is and isn't sick from a 2 mile up in the air kind of look down on the world. To providers in the actual in the field who are assessing patients, it's pretty easy to figure out people who are going to be at high risk and those who are not. And so if someone is a higher risk, although they may be stratified within the reporting system as sort of the same kind of level, you're going to be discouraged from taking care of that patient because the likely outcome is going to be worse, and therefore your institution is going to look worse, or you personally as maybe, say, a surgeon. And why that matters is not because most patients look these things up, but it's because that these are looked up and used by the government when it comes to payment. And they'll penalize institutions, which could be worth millions, tens of millions of dollars, and sometimes even hundreds of millions of dollars. And so the stakes are very high in this sort of game of reporting. And so what happens, of course, is that it discourages people from being cared for. Oftentimes, the people who have the least ability to protect themselves, because obviously if you're someone who is important, let's say, you know, the president or some senator or someone who gets sick, everything's going to be done for you. You know, public reporting, no one cares. But they're absolutely going to care about outcomes if you're just Joe Schmo off the street. And so for a person who is not in medicine, this can't be any more important. So anyway, we're going to talk about Dr. Koka, who has written extensively on this and other subjects in healthcare. He has a co-host of his own podcast, which we'll talk about in a little bit during the show. But a couple housekeeping things to take care of first. As always, you can go to patreon.com/theparadox, and there you can support the show. All the money raised there goes towards the production and the promotion of the show. I appreciate the patrons not only for their financial support, which helps pay for all this stuff, but also for the encouragement. As you probably know, there's been some difficult times in my family, and so not only have you, the listener, but those patrons have provided a lot of very encouraging support, and I appreciate that. So I'd encourage you to go there and sign up and become a patron. That will allow you the opportunity to get a hold of some bonus materials, not only some interviews I've had in some other podcasts, but soon I will be producing new content, and I'm going to pull all the patrons, so heads up, guys, to find out what kind of things you'd like, whether it's a 5 minutes rant on something once a week on medicine or whatever you guys are interested in hearing from me. So I'll start providing that pretty soon. And so it'll be an added bonus for those who are supporters on Patreon. That's patreon.com. Show notes for today's show can be found at theparadox.com/021. I can't believe I'm actually all the way to episode 21, 21 weeks into the show and going strong. I appreciate all the referrals that people are making and sharing with your friends. Clearly, show is very far more popular than I anticipated being at this point, although I'm far from going viral, as my late son would always tease me. I definitely appreciate all the people listening. So without further ado, Dr. Anish Koka and public reporting. Enjoy. Well, hi, I'm here with Anish Koka, who's a physician out in Philadelphia, the area. He's a cardiologist, and he is a co-host of the Akkad and Koka Report. I'm not sure how you got second billing, but I suppose Michelle just claimed it was because he had came first in the alphabet, I suppose, right? But,
exactly right.
He writes extensively on the healthcare blog and medical economics. You can find his pieces on healthcare sort of all over, and he's active on Twitter as well. And I have discovered that Dr. Koka is not active on Facebook. So that's a good way to get a hold of you. But thank you so much for being on tonight.
Thanks for having me.
So today, it's interesting. I tell people all the time that when I started this podcast, this is going to be episode 21. I, for one thing, didn't think I had more than four or five episodes in that I had in sort of in the can. And then it wasn't before long, you start running into all sorts of different subjects. I know you've got a healthcare podcast as well, which is really excellent. I'd highly recommend anyone to listen to as well. But do you find that too, where you think you've sort of, you've got like four ideas and then before you know it, you've got eight or 10 because there's so many things sort of pop up.
Yeah. And it kind of Twitter kind of does that to you. You know, it's like, it's very hard to focus on any one specific thing because every 15 minutes, there's some other issue that's being raised. It's like, oh man, like I have something to say about that.
Right. I mean, that's what I think has been great about the podcast. It is a great avenue. Well, like I've said before, I have very few artistic talents. I can't draw. I can't sing. I can't write really well, but I can talk okay. And I've got, I think, interesting take on things. And so it certainly gives you an avenue to get to teach people. I mean, we don't focus on physicians here, except the fact that there are two docs on, but it's the focus is on just medicine, which I think is, to even the layman, is pretty interesting, especially the things we're talking about, which I absolutely affect everybody because everybody at some point has contact with medicine.
Yeah, no, absolutely true.
Today, I want to talk to you about one of the pieces you've written. And you, again, like I said, you've written quite a bit. So I'd recommend people just check you out and kind of find all the things you've written. You wrote an interesting piece on medical school. We won't talk about that today. We're going to talk about public reporting because it's something that's not, I don't think it's very well known to most people. I think most people recognize there is public reporting of consumer, ratings of things. You know, if you go to Amazon, there's a 5-star rating, and certainly that's becoming more prevalent in medicine as well. You know, when you see if you try and search any physician to try and find someone, like the 12th hit, if you're lucky, is going to be the practice. The first 10 are going to be, you know, these whatever. I can't even think of the like healthcare.com and all these sorts of different rating systems that always have like one rating on you or something.
Right, exactly.
But public reporting is a little different. And so why don't you just kind of go into the background of what it is and then why it should matter to someone who doesn't know anything about it?
Yeah. You know, the desire for public reporting goes back a long way. There's this idea that there's a lot of healthcare being delivered in the country and we have to find some way to signal to the consumer, you know, signal to the patient what is high value and what is not. So, so as far back as 1984, when CMS used to be called Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, is currently called CMS, used to be called the Healthcare Financing Administration or the HCFA, it started to publicly report hospital mortality rates of Medicare patients. And, you know, the agency identified 250 hospitals or so that were outliers with regards to death rates. And they just put that out for the public to, for public perusal. And, you know, as is the common theme, though they attempted to adjust for a variety of risk factors, it was heavily criticized by the hospitals and the physicians at the time. And eventually they just stopped publishing the data. But there's clearly a desire and a demand for some type of reporting of providers and of hospitals. And so, you know, the next iteration for it, and I will posit, and I'm fairly firm in this belief that part of the big push for it is not necessarily from patients, but I think the major push is from folks that are interested in bending the healthcare cost curve. So, you know, New York and Pennsylvania, I'm a physician who's been practicing in, who practices in Philadelphia. New York and Pennsylvania followed suit, and they started reporting public cardiac surgery outcomes. And, you know, it's specifically the Pennsylvania charter, for instance, was the Pennsylvania Healthcare Council, and they were specifically charged with improving the quality of care and restraining healthcare costs.
Right.
And so, you know, you have these two kind of, they can compete against each other. And, you know, they have these public kind of, every year they put out these report of what expected mortality should be based on, you know, risk of patients that are being done and what, and then the public then can see that. Mostly the public ignores it, but what happens is that some journalist in some local paper will pick it up and pick you up as an outlier and then scream headlines saying, aha, you know, this hospital down here is an outlier in terms of this, that, you know, in order right. to generate a lot of buzz. So public reporting now is everywhere. Now, I mean, the most recent iteration, I guess, would be what ProPublica did. ProPublica took a bunch of data that's publicly available and using some proprietary algorithm that they have with some input from a bunch of healthcare policy folks came up with a surgeon specific, kind of ranking system.
Right.
And they put this all out there as well. And, you know, the video, I mean, for anyone listening, I mean, physicians especially who are listening, the video that ProPublica put out, you know, in terms of the teaser trailer for, hey, use this public reporting system to figure out who you, you know, figure out where to go. It's like this ominous soundtrack about 400,000 people every year die because of the medical system. And how will you figure out whether, you know, where to go? You know, the decision is life or death. And, you know, right. here we have this like beautiful system that tells you, you know, where to go. It's a very long answer to your question, but that's kind of where we're at with public reporting. You have all sorts of folks that are, you know, pushing out these ranking systems of healthcare systems for the public to kind of peruse and make decisions on healthcare based on that.
Right, and so it becomes very complicated because it's not like. I guess when you're looking at outcomes, it's not like ranking a Ford Explorer or a Toyota Prius or something like that, because you don't have something that's mass produced that has reliable sort of components and you have expectations for how everything works.
Right.
Because, you know, we're both physicians and everybody is completely different. They respond differently to medications. They have their disease process presents differently. They have totally different backgrounds. And so, to try and stratify risks and outcomes is really difficult. I mean, I can't stress enough how hard it is, and it's not like it's not possible. There is a way to sort of figure out what is high quality and low quality healthcare, I suppose. But to get very specific, I think it's probably an impossible undertaking.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's very, very, very hard to do to get granular enough, as you're saying, to truly figure this out. And so I know, you know, a lot of the policy folks think that's an easy out. And
yeah,
but you know, it's incredibly hard. I think it's incredibly hard to risk adjust, and you have all sorts of issues that. That come to bear, years of training, volume, the available support team, meaning suppose you're the greatest surgeon in the world, but you have, you know, an anesthesia, a critical care anesthesia team that perhaps isn't as good. I mean, you know, it's just super hard to figure out. And the thing is, Eric, we have, at least we used to have, a fairly reasonable mechanism to sort out how and where to send folks. You know, we had these network of independent physicians who, you know, are very invested in their patients and their patients doing well, not only because they care about their patients, have, you know, these deep 10, 15 year relationships with their patients.
Right.
But you know, it's sort of a simple matter that if you have a lot of bad outcomes, if you send your patients to somebody who has a lot of bad outcomes, why will other people come to see you, right? So you're super, super invested as, you know, as a, say, as a small, independent group of physicians in terms of your patients doing well. And so you, it behooves you to know who is very good at doing aortic valve surgery. It behooves you to know who is especially skilled at, you know, placing a left ventricular lead for, you know, recent coronation therapy. Or it behooves you to know that, okay, this person is skilled, has a terrible bedside manner, and when there's a problem, you know, and the patient calls that office for a problem, you know, they get nowhere, right?
Right, right, right.
Again, so, you know, that's the type of granular information that your local doctor who has a shingle out on the street, that's the kind of information that he has, that you have access to if you, you know, go to see him and have him be your guide, right? The idea that, like, you're going to replace that type of information with some stupid, score based on publicly available mortality statistics, and you know what the age and the morbidity of the patients are that are coming into a certain surgeon. That seems a very, very heavy lift.
Right, and so I think to give the listeners an idea of what we're talking about as far as scoring system, as you can imagine, it's you could have a super specific scoring system, let's say a 1,000-point scale. Well, that'd be almost impossible to sort of score someone. It takes so much time to actually score and you know, figure out the exact, you know, where you are on the 1,000, you're certain to die and you're not. And so what every specialty has, or many researchers when they're doing papers, they try and evaluate and give you an idea sort of overall sort of mortality risks for based on the patient, maybe their liver disease or their cardiac disease. And so I'll just give you an example when it comes to for anesthesia. So we have classification systems for our patients. Mm-hmm. They're called ASA, which is the American Society of Anesthesiology. We have basically 1 through 6. So 1 is someone who has absolutely no disease at all. And so that's the totally healthy person that comes in and, you know, they're just for a well check or something, or maybe they just have their appendix is they need an appendectomy. They might be a 1. So a 2 is someone who's got a disease that doesn't cause any problems. It's a something that's controlled. Maybe they have high blood pressure or some gastroesophageal reflux disease or, you know, something like that. That's well controlled medications. Then you move up to the 3rd, which someone with a severe systemic disease where they've got poorly controlled diabetes or high blood pressure or something. And so right away, you can recognize if you know nothing about medicine, there's quite a big step between 2 and 3, right?
Right.
So now you go to 4, and 4 is someone with something that is has a disease that's systemic, like, you know, diabetes or something. That is a constant threat to their life. So there's potentially could die at any moment from this. And so again, that's a gigantic leap between 3 and 4. And now you go to 5, and that's someone who's basically about dead, and they're almost certainly going to die. Right. And 6 is somebody who's brain dead. So. Right. And that's how we actually, and so that's how we score all of our surgeries in our, and through the CMS. And so that they actually use the ASA status. And so you can see that's not a very good way of figuring out who's taking care of the tough patient. Because as you pointed out, when it comes to the difficult patient, there's someone who's got a couple systemic diseases and they're, you know, it's gonna be a tricky case, let's say a tricky surgery. That local knowledge that people have, like, oh, this is the surgeon who can do this and can pull this off, you know, there's a good chance this person is going to die. But I, you know, it's 100% chance they're going to die if it's not the best person who I happen to know who it is. And so then that's where we get into the point where now you have these perverse incentives for the healthcare system or the hospital or the surgeon or the, you know, the care team, because of these scoring systems. And that's sort of the part of the public reporting that is the insidious part of it, right? That you talked about in your paper.
Right, right. No, yeah. I mean, it's well said. I mean, it's just, it requires somebody like you, Eric, to kind of delve a little deeper than the, you know, the kind of these categorical responses that we currently employ. So, I mean, the statisticians, I don't know. I have a tough time understanding a lot of what the statisticians seem to be saying. But the statisticians would seem to say, well, the problem is categorizing. You shouldn't categorize. Mm-hmm. But it seems to me like, you know, so, you know, Frank Carroll is one of the statisticians who frequently is on there talking about, all the information that's lost when you categorize. And it's what we're saying right now. I mean, we kind of intuitively understand that.
Sure.
I think any experienced clinician kind of goes beyond just whatever categorical risk scores there are. But it seems like, you know, why are they trying to, essentially they're trying to recreate Eric Larson from in the scores, and they always seem to fall incredibly, incredibly short of doing that. So.
And the whole point of this whole thing, so the point of public reporting, of course, is to give it is to, at least ostensibly, is to allow people to have an idea of where they're going to get good healthcare.
Right.
But of course, ultimately, we know that that's not really what happens. Right. I mean, so the reason this is a problem is because now suddenly there's this incentive for the hospital to not take care of people who are potentially going to make their numbers look bad. Right. And that goes for the surgeon, and that goes for, you know, the other care teams. And it is not difficult for me to look at an ASA3 person. Let's say, you know, that's that third stage where someone's got something that's not well controlled, and say someone, I know one who's very sick ASA3, and I can see a very healthy ASA3. And so I can tell you which ones are not going to do well, which ones are going to do well. Although in using any sort of classification system you want, it's going to look kind of the same to the statistician who's wherever.
Right.
And so what it happens, of course, is that it's going to cause real problems with patient care. Right. And so that's, and the reason that the hospitals care so much is, I think, not real. I probably should be careful how I say this, but I don't think outcomes are necessarily what hospitals are so worried about. They are worried more about the consequences of the perceived outcomes that they have.
Yeah, right. I mean, the game now is, you know, I mean, it's interesting. The U.S., well, no, let me say first that this is why the public needs to care about this. The public needs to care about this because there is clearly risk avoidance that takes place, whether it be subconscious or consciously, by the operators that are going to get dinged if they have a bad outcome. So if you're an operator that's going to have a bad, that is going to get dinged by something, but, you know, because your outcomes are being publicly reported, say, you are simply put not going to have the same attitude towards taking care of super sick patients as you did before. And guess where the biggest gains are to be had? The biggest gains are to be had in terms of, you know, turning things around for a patient. The biggest gains are to be had not in your ASA class one super healthy person. This person is going to do well almost regardless of what you do.
No matter what they do, yes.
Yeah, the biggest gains are to be had in those patients that, you know, are very sick. You know, where, you know, if you don't do something, that, you know, their life expectancy is 3 days, but if you do something right, you know, their life expectancy could be 30 years. And so, you know, it's kind of insidious that, you know, it actually harms the most vulnerable and the sick among us. And that's the story that I wrote.
Right. So why don't you go through that story? And because I think that's really, that illuminates sort of the whole situation that we're talking about. Because I think we're sort of giving sort of almost too broad a picture. And so let's just talk specifically why public reporting matters, because it absolutely influenced this story that you wrote about.
Yeah. I had a patient, a real story, and, you know, I got permission from the family to, so that I could, you know, tell the real story. And it was a gentleman that came in with, he's a dialysis patient who came in with aortic valve endocarditis. And he was discovered pretty rapidly, and then 24, 48 hours, he was decompensating, and it was discovered within that time that he needed his valve fixed. There was no other treatment. His mortality was 100% unless his valve was fixed. And because I've been practicing, you know, for about a decade or so now, or close to a decade or so now, you know, for me, it was fairly automatic. This was a gentleman who needed his valve fixed, and, you know, call a surgeon, and surgeons, you know, would take this man to the OR and try to fix his valve. Now, he was, you know, he was in his 50s. He had a good quality of life, reasonably good quality of life before, you know, would play his guitar, you know, go out to dinner with his wife. So yes, he was on dialysis. But he wasn't, this wasn't somebody who was at a nursing home with a feeding tube where, you know, there was no quality of life here. This was a guy who was pretty darn functional, has had a good quality of life. And he has this acute problem that will kill him in a matter of 3, 4, 5 days unless you do something. And, you know, remarkably, I could not find a surgeon who would operate on him. I called, you know, surgeons at the institution where he was at wouldn't operate on him. The larger, higher volume institution that was in the city wouldn't operate on him. I called Johns Hopkins. And Johns Hopkins said, nope, we won't operate on him. Now, and, you know, in talking to, you know, one of the very senior cardiothoracic surgeons about what exactly, what's going on, he said, no, without a doubt, look, this is a function of public reporting. I think I have a quote in the blog from him that says that, like, you know, yeah. You know, society has to understand that there's consequences, and the consequences of public reporting are this, that you will turn away some folks that are super sick that have a high mortality. I mean, you know, I think he said specifically, he's a casualty of public reporting system we have in the United States.
Yeah, a literal casualty.
Yeah, yeah, and you know, and it's terrible, and you know, and Joe was his name, and Joe died. You know, Joe died.
Right.
You know, within days of all these turndowns. So yeah, I think, and we're not going to see, you know, our job as physicians is to look out for the vulnerable, look out for the sick, right? And I don't think the vast majority of folks are listening or caring about this, because the folks that are really getting impacted are the very, very sick, the very sick folks that are, you know, the small minority. Also, the other thing that that's upsetting is that, that, you know, if it was somebody with connections, if it was some affluent person who had,
well, right,
you know, I
well,
mean,
it was the president, let's say.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if that person was on dialysis and whatnot, you look, that person, nobody's going to turn that person away, right? So that's what was especially upsetting. You know, we want to pride ourselves as, you know, oh, you know, equal this and equal that, and but the long and short of it is that, look, if you're average everyday Joe who's very sick and has a high morbidity, high mortality, look, the health system isn't going to take one on the chin for you. Isn't going to take the chance of taking it on the chin for you. So, you know, yeah, I think it's terrible. So I do think, look, it's not that I think that the medical care is perfect. I think there's continuous improvement that can happen. It has happened and hopefully will continue to happen. And look, there's a lot of variability of care that exists in the United States. And some of that variability in care is subpar. And we have to, as a medical community, figure out a way to try to kind of, lift all these boats so that everyone, you know, we can try to improve the kind of care that's given. But we have to do it in a way that isn't pejorative, that actually ends up harming the folks that most need it. So I think, you know, some system of reporting that isn't public is probably the way to go. You know, some panel of folks you have to report to in terms of what happened and why this happened and whatnot. You know, that would be a smarter approach. But unfortunately, we've kind of abdicated all of this to this, you know, this public reporting model. And it's like dogma. I don't understand it. I don't understand it at all.
Right.
It's like, fine, we tried it. It's ridiculous. It's associated with, bad outcomes. It's associated with risk aversion. There are surveys that are done by a number of folks and they self-report the surgeon's report. Yes, if there's public reporting, we will act differently. In New York State, when they looked at, and they did this for coronary interventions, you know, the number of people that who were presenting in shock, who were being intervened on, like dropped dramatically, right?
Right.
And once they excluded, you know, once they like were like, oh, okay, this is maybe not a good idea. Once they excluded that, you know, excluded the diagnosis of shock when you're coming in, that suddenly now, you know, they started doing more of those folks. I mean, this is incredible stuff, right? I mean, you know, people have a cow when you talk about, oh my God, fee-for-service incentivizes right. people to do this and that. You literally have a system in place that is incentivizing doctors not to take the sickest people sickest, most vulnerable patients to give them therapy. And everyone is just like sitting on their hands being like, hey, well, you know.
Right. Well, and I think an important point to state here is that we're not talking about fetal cases. We're not talking about, this guy's got to get his valve done, but you know, he's going to die no matter what we do, but we're just going to do something because we can do it. Like, you know, that was it Obama who was talking about all the unnecessary surgeries done and all this. Right. I mean, this is not what we're talking about. I mean, there is definitely a line, which is why you want physicians who are there capable of saying, you know, your chance of surviving this is very low. If you do survive, your recovery is going to be 6 months in the ICU, and you get a trach, and you get all, so your quality of life will be very low even if this works out well for you. And then people can make, you know, informed decisions of whether they proceed with the surgery, or for instance, or whatever, or the treatment. But we're talking about things that are pretty straightforward. Like someone comes in, as you said, in shock. So this is someone who's had a heart attack, basically, or having a heart attack, and they need someone to put a stent in their artery so that they get blood flow to the heart and that it saves their life. But it can be risky, right? And so the reason that public reporting is in, so in my opinion, so I'm going to play your partner's part here.
Yeah.
And the only reason that hospitals really care, and I would say in most people care at this point, is now those mortality scores and your outcomes are reflected by how much you get reimbursed from the government payers. And to my knowledge, it does not affect your third party paying for commercial, but where you lie on that mortality morbidity scale will absolutely affect how you are paid by the government.
Right.
And so there's a tremendous, and it doesn't just affect like just the surgery, right? It's all your payments to your hospital. And so there's, so you try and maximize, or I should say minimize, your risks to poor scores. There are stories of hospitals that are pushing anesthesiologists to change their scoring for a patient's health, right? And so, there's nothing wrong with that in the sense that the way we score 1, 2, or 3, like I was talking about, I mean, it's somewhat subjective. If someone's a 2 or a 3, there's also a designation for E for emergency. Well, what is an emergency? Well, a surgeon thinks everything's an emergency. It's an anesthesiologist. But is it really an emergency? Is an appendectomy emergency if it has to be done within 24 hours? You know, those there. But if you put an E on the end of it, now that helps the hospital's mortality morbidity score. So it means everything to the hospital. And so they have committees that might form to try and make sure you're scoring properly. Because their payments are dependent on it. And so I wonder in many ways how much physicians would care about the public reporting if they weren't being, there wasn't such external pressure on payment.
Right, right. Yeah, no, right. I mean. Yeah.
Because then the patients are, you know, if the patients and their physician, who their primary care person or whatever, whoever it is that recommends that look, and like you said, your reputation as a primary care physician is entirely dependent to not only how well you treat that patient, but who you send them to when there are things that are outside your specialty, right? If you send people to the wrong physician all the time, well, they're not going to like you either, no matter how great your bedside manners.
Right. No, exactly right.
And so I wonder if it's because we have this goofy system that the public reporting is actually an issue. And do you think it'd be as much of an issue if it was, you know, if there wasn't
this, again,
this is like 10% penalty for Medicare payments?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, this overarching theme, like I said in the beginning, the reason public reporting kind of rose from the ashes is because it's a cost. It's an attempt to bend the cost curve. I mean, they may dress it up and say, "Oh, it's for quality, and we want to penal." You know, we want to just all we want to do is reward the best. You know, the best hospitals and help patients, and it's all about quality and safety. But really, I think everyone knows that it's really about cost containment. So I mean, and the only tools that folks that think in a, you know, in a three-dimensional world, they think in two dimensions. the only tools that they have is what we're talking about is pay for performance, is is, well, we can measure this and this. And so if we can measure it, then we can base quality off of it, right?
Right.
I think absolutely there's this giant amount of momentum towards ranking folks and valuing folks because they want to attach payment to it, like you're saying. And if you don't rank folks, if you don't measure things, if you don't, count the beans, then how the heck are you going to then attach payments to that? And so I don't know. I don't know how that's going to get. I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that is the way it is. And there are movements afoot to try to break that. But man, it's there's certainly a lot of people that aren't interested in that.
Well, and I will talk to people oftentimes about when it comes to CMS, and that's Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. I mean, if you look even at medical education, how it's changed significantly over since you and I trained, and even before we did. You talk to someone who has been in practice, let's say 30 years, and they trained in the early 90s in medical school.
Right.
They were, as a medical student, they were doing all the notes. They were actually taking care of patients. Now they were under the guidance of a resident, usually someone who's in that specialty, but they were actively involved in the care of patients. You fast forward to today, and the medical students are, they're sort of the fly in the wall, and it's not anything that they've done, but it's because of the system that I've always felt, and this is just pure conjecture, but I feel like that CMS was always looking for ways to cut spending, and that they would change the rules and hope that people would be just slow adopting them. and so for instance, you'd say, well, no longer is that medical student note adequate for documentation for what the patients, for the patients' care. Right. So now the junior resident has to write it. Well, some medical schools might be a little bit slower adopting, or private institutions, and so they get dinged for their payment for a year or two, and they kind of catch up. And then they say, well, no longer the junior resident, now it's got to be the chief resident. And then before you know it, it's now the attending. And so before you know it, what the medical student is doing is completely inconsequential to the care of the patient. Their contribution is really tangential at most, right?
Right.
And so now they are not participating in the care at all. And it's not because of anything that they can't do, because it's more just a reflection of the work needs to get done. Documentation needs to be performed. And now everything's just been devalued. And so just from a time standpoint, if you're chief resident, you got to do all this stuff, this work, instead of overseeing a bunch of things and guiding people. Now you're forced to do all this sort of busy work, I guess you'd say.
Yeah. Whereas, Eric, you're not saying that beautiful 12-page epic note with the review systems and like every possible documentation. You're not saying that's doesn't have value.
Oh, I think it has value. What's interesting about, what's interesting about that is now we produce those 12-page H&Ps, right?
Yeah.
But we do it in a 5-minute visit.
Yeah.
With the AHRs. Right. And so the quality of that 12-page is actually, it's not worth anything because we didn't establish any rapport with the patient. We didn't really ask those. Well, we asked the questions, but maybe on a survey form they filled out in the lobby or they talked to the MA. So there.
Right. So I really, really despair for the profession. I mean, I think we think we're advancing, but what we're really doing by, and you're right, we've stripped medical students out of the process. Forget medical students. We've stripped residents from the process.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It is pretty common that I walk through ICUs now and the only folks I see are NPs.
Right.
Right. And it's because, we've made the job one of being, clickers, and, we got to reduce variability in care. So, click, 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 and, put this protocol in, and I just put this order set on. And when you make the job, when you make medicine order sets and clicks and, making sure your discharge summaries are things and making sure your messages are checked off, and, then everyone's happy with you. If that's what you make medicine, then you are easily replaced by a provider.
Well, right.
You've devalued, being a doctor. So.
But from a patient standpoint, the reason you should care is because you have lost the person who's doing the diagnostician, the person who's going to figure things out. Because if you're just following an algorithm, all the time, you're not going to get good care. There's without a doubt. I mean, there's no question, because, and I don't know why people have such a hard time grasping this, because when I say, oh, you know, everybody's different, they respond differently to, you know, medicines and stuff. They're like, sort of. But I will say, you know, if you do go to an anatomy lab, it's a tremendous amount of variation. You see where, you know, nerves are and muscles connect and how, and people are like, really? I'm like, well, if you look at people, no one is surprised that two people don't look alike on the outside.
Yeah.
Yet for some reason, we think everybody looks exactly the same on the inside. It's bizarre, really. I mean, if you think about it for a second, you're like, oh, well, of course it makes sense that everyone's different on the inside too. So you can't possibly have any sort of system that is going to treat everybody the same, because everybody is absolutely not the same.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But the problem is, the game is we're so far gone, meaning we're so into cookbook medicine. We're so into, oh, you know, the latest sepsis guidelines, says we should give everyone 30 cc's per kg of making that number up per of fluid, that, you know, so it, meaning it doesn't matter to be like a good doctor. It doesn't matter if you're the resident or the NP or the PA or whatever. Like, your job, once you see the heart rate is over 100 and they've met the 2 out of 4 SIRS criteria and the lactate has automatically been ordered and it's 2.4, your job now is to initiate protocol X and do, you know, 12 things. And literally, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's the NP doing that, the PA doing that. Now, you would hope, you know that we were still living in a world where you had somebody who was using this, you know, their large experience, their understanding of physiology, their understanding of, you know, anatomy or what have you, to know that, like, well, this person has an EF of 30%, and maybe, just maybe, when we resuscitate this person for sepsis, we should resuscitate them differently than the 30-year-old with a pneumonia.
Right.
And again, that's, and all that is lost. It's like, well, the lactate was 2.2, so, you know, that's why we, you know, we initiated large volume resuscitation. It's like, well, okay, good. He's in pulmonary edema, and I guess that's, you know, cardiology consult for me. Great.
Right. More business for you. Well, right. And you'll see definitely far more consults and use of specialists.
Right.
Where before people would, they would be able to kind of figure things out on their own, because, you know, that there's some common problems. And it's always difficult, I think, if you're looking at it from an industry standpoint. I hate calling healthcare an industry, but it is, I mean, in many ways, right? It is very difficult to look at it and say, well, there are absolutely some things that make things safer. For instance, you know, if a pharmacist always filled out exactly what you write down, maybe you were tired and or your handwriting is bad, which happened all the time, right? And then someone got the wrong medication. And so by having electronic, you know, prescriptions, and there are ways of eliminating errors that could occur.
Right.
And so without a doubt, those things made things safer.
Yeah.
The problem is that was then used, those sort of solutions were used in mass to try and fix all sorts of problems. And I think there are some problems that can be fixed with algorithms and, you know, having an idea, for instance, like ACLS, right? We all kind of know how we sort of approach a coat when someone's heart stops or, and those, again, although even there is definitely some problem solving that occurs, right? Why the heart stop, right? You have to figure that out, because if you just kind of do the same thing every time, you're not going to fix, you might not be providing adequate care, but there's a balance, right? Like anything, there's some advantage to those sort of algorithms, but the system is, it sounds like the Borg or something, the system, but, these healthcare systems are so in love with these, because it makes it, if they can make things standardized, it's a lot easier for them to figure out to replace people. And then also just to standardize the results, which is probably not the best for patients.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The interesting thing, you know, in terms of public reporting is that the folks that probably, you know, I at least of what I know of it, the folks that probably do the best job is probably the U.S. News and World Report. You know, in terms of their philosophy is not necessarily to shame you, right? That's the that's the ProPublica approach. The ProPublica approach is like, this is terrible. Right. My God, this is like,
these are people who kill you, right?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this heart failure program that is located in the worst socioeconomic, probably the poorest area, they have the worst outcomes. And oh my God, clearly this is like well outside of our, expected mortality.
Right.
And then they'll find some disgruntled employees who'll say, oh, this person was arrogant and this cardiologist was driving a Porsche. Oh my God. I'm putting together ProPublica, the New York Times and stuff. But my point is there's an approach to it by certain areas of healthcare journalism that is very much into shaming. And I think that is just fundamentally bad for so many different reasons. Meaning, if you were good enough, if Michael Jordan is allowed to be arrogant and a prick because he was so amazing. Now, if ProPublica had such an amazing algorithm that it was spot on, right? Maybe they could run around being that arrogant about it. But they are just so utterly bad. I don't know how many people. Saurabh Jha, a radiologist who writes a lot. He wrote a fantastic piece when ProPublica's surgeon scorecard came out. I'd urge anyone to read it. And just kind of tearing apart the nonsense that ProPublica does. But that approach, I think, is far inferior to what the U.S. News & World Report does, which is just identify, the best and say, oh, look, these are outliers that look to be much better. The other reason the U.S. News & World Report, I think, does a better job is because, almost a third of their score is based on reputation.
Right. So where are you going to refer?
Yeah, exactly. So it's based on a bunch of doctors saying, yeah, Cleveland Clinic is awesome for this surgery, right?
Right, right.
So the score integrates your local knowledge.
Yeah.
Integrates the local knowledge that exists about who's good and who's bad. And that's, that's probably not a bad way to do it. Though I would argue that, why do we need the extra data points if that's probably the most important thing?
Right.
Of it all. So,
right. I think a good parallel to this is if you look at education, I think we all, just like I'm here trying to talk about state that people are different as far as how well they can take care of themselves and how they respond to treatments and, that the gradation system is very complicated. It's exactly the same in education, right? I mean, you could have a fantastic teacher in a situation where with the classroom of students whose, families are a disaster. They're not, maybe not eating enough food and they're coming in hungry. They're not sleeping. There's, gunfire outside the house, whatever. And so there's no way that kid is going to do well. And any scoring system you have is not going to be fair. Right. And to try and grade between teachers, I think it's oftentimes it's more a reflection of what's going on elsewhere. I mean, there is no question there's a difference in quality of teachers. But to try and use standardized scoring or some sort of blunt measure is probably not the best way to figure it out. But if you talk to people whose kids went through that school, they're going to know who the good teachers were.
Right.
I mean, for the most, right. You talked about 10 parents, they're going to know the bad ones and the good ones that you could have. I don't know what the state scoring system is, but you don't really care about it because with the local, like you said, the local knowledge of people who went through the school or knowledge of the school,
right.
They'll know the right places. And so that's a far more effective way. But of course, with funding that comes from outside of this would be from usually state funding or something. And so they have to have, they feel there has to be some sort of way of scoring things for payment to punish people who are bad. But they probably, it's because the money comes from so far away from people who have no way of having local knowledge that there's just no adequate way that they can actually do that. Similar to from DC trying to send money to a hospital in, Billings, Montana.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And as soon as that happens, I think you get all sorts of gaming and, the payers in the sense of responding to, signals that, they're being kind of taken for a ride and this is their way of pushing back. It's just, a silly system that Dr. Akkad is constantly trying to completely blow up. I just want to blow it up a little bit.
He's willing to go in with a nuke, I think. And I don't know, maybe that's the way to do it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Sometimes nibbling may not work very well. So I appreciate you coming on and talking about the public reporting. Super interesting. I hope people understand kind of what we're talking about, because again, it absolutely affects, if you're not someone who's really sick, I guarantee you have a relative, a great aunt or grandfather or someone who's, or someone ends up in the ICU. These things are really important. And if you have people who just throw up their hands like, well, you know, sorry, there's nothing we can do, when there probably was something they can do. Well, that's more important than ProPublica saying, oh, this place is terrible, if there's some place that's just willing to just give up right away. And that's why this is super important. I don't know what to do about it. I can't offer any solutions. Sometimes you're like, there's a legislative, like, we just changed this law. Here, if you got rid of public reporting, I still think CMS is going to have, they're still going to have some sort of system where they're going to penalize, or because they want to try and save money. Like you said, bending the cost curve, they want to try and find ways to people to pay less.
it's certainly a vexing problem that does not have any easy solutions.
But so for listeners who are interested in reading more of your stuff, what's the best way to sort of find your writing?
I guess Google. If you
well, they just end up with healthcare grades.
Exactly. If you go to the healthcareblog.com, I think there's a author search there where you can search by name. But
and what's your Twitter handle?
Oh, my Twitter handle is Anish_Koka. So Anish_Koka. So
and that's probably the best way, right? Just kind of because you sort of linked to your stuff and then other things there. And,
right. Exactly.
Since you're a Twitterer. well, again, thanks so much. And I recommend everyone catch the Akkad Koka report. I've had Akkad and I've had Koka, so I don't know. If you guys had another person, I guess I'll have to have you on too. But, thanks again so much. And I hope that we can maybe someday figure out what better way to report things.
Yeah, absolutely. Eric, thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Paradox. If you like what The Doc is doing, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. And share the show with your friends. Become a supporting listener to get access to special bonuses at patreon.com/The Paradox. Show notes can be found at theparadox.com.